Hello and welcome to Managing AML. I am Dr. Naval Davar, and today I am joined by my colleague, Dr. Courtney DiNardo. Today we will discuss new data in acute myeloid leukemia and how it translates to practice by reviewing four different case scenarios. This is the first case. This is a 57-year-old with fatigue, shortness of breath, and loss of appetite for the last 4 weeks, seen by his primary care doctor, chest x-ray with no abnormalities. Here you see the blood counts, white count of 27, hemoglobin's 8, platelet count of 34,000. Slightly elevated creatinine and LDH, other electrolytes are within normal range, has a good ECOG performance status, works as a mechanical engineer, has continued to work full-time at this time, has hypertension and no other comorbidities, and no family history of malignancy. Is a non-smoker, occasional alcohol use 1 to 2 times per week. So the patient, as is usually done, is referred same day to the hematologist, and a bone marrow was done. This showed 77% blast, consistent with acute myeloid leukemia, no dysplastic changes. The cytogenetics were rushed, and these came back 3 to 4 days later, showing a diploid karyotype. Molecular panel was also rushed, and the NGS showed FLT3 ITD mutation with an allelic ratio of 0.58, NPM1 mutation, and DNMT3A mutations. So at this time, I will ask Dr. DiNardo, is this a common patient that you would see, and what would be your initial thoughts for this patient?
I think, well, certainly AML is not a particularly common cancer, but in terms of AML, this is one of the more common case scenarios we will see, which is a relatively young, in the terms of AML, kind of 40s to 50-year-old, presenting with a elevated white cell count, and in the setting of a high white cell count, kind of proliferative disease, and oftentimes we'll see an intermediate type cytogenetic, diploid cytogenetics with a FLT3 ITD mutation. So I think in my mind, when I'm seeing a patient with leukocytosis with a white count higher than normal, I'm always thinking, you know, could this patient have a FLT3 ITD mutation?
Yeah, and I think that's the key with this leukocytosis, as we discuss in our meetings very frequently in the leukemia department here at MD Anderson. Some of our first thoughts are a FLT3 mutation, and then sometimes we're seeing RAS-MAP kinase mutations also presenting with such proliferative features, PTPN11, RAS. So these are patients we usually want to wait for molecular testing. Of course, they're proliferative, so you want to control their white count. You can admit them, do hydrea. Sometimes we give one dose of cytarabine if they're really proliferative, white count above 70, 80. But we definitely want to get their FLT3 testing, especially since we enroll many of these patients on frontline FLT3 trials. But in the community, these would be the patients you want to look out for use of frontline FLT3 inhibitors, such as with midostaurin, sorafenib, or gilteritinib. So just to throw it out there, what are the treatment options for this patient? So these are, we have a good situation now in AML emerging where we have a lot of good treatment options, but still there are some that are better than others for a given scenario. So these are all approved treatments or NCCN guideline-based treatments, azacitidine venetoclax, of course, 3+7 standard, FLAG-IDA that is being used quite frequently in many countries as well now in many centers in the U.S., 3+7 with midostaurin, which is a multi-kinase inhibitor that also targets FLT3, induction therapy with gilteritinib, which is second-generation FLT3 inhibitor, or 3+7 with gemtuzumab, ozogamicin, CD33 antibody drug conjugate, which is also approved in the frontline setting, used more frequently in core-binding factor type of acute myeloid leukemia. So here I would ask Dr. DiNardo, what would your thoughts be for this patient? Which regimens would you consider, and how would you approach the patient?
Right. I think, you know, I think the most important thing in a patient with a, in it is, well, first of all, I suppose, is deciding, is your patient going to receive an intensive chemotherapy-based or non-intensive chemotherapy-based treatment? And what we have heard so far from this patient, who is in their 50s, who has a good performance status and doesn't have any significant underlying comorbidities, this is definitely someone I would be thinking for an intensive chemotherapy regimen. And given the FLT3 ITD allelic ratio, I would be prioritizing an intensive chemotherapy with a FLT3 inhibitor. And so, you know, so I think options 4 and 5 on my list are top. You know, if you are at a community center around the world, you know, 3+7 with midostaurin is the standard here. We are participating in several clinical trials with second generation FLT3 inhibitors that may kind of surpass the role of midostaurin in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the key here is, given the FLT3 mutation, we absolutely would be preferring a FLT3 inhibitor based midostaurin currently approved based on the RATIFY study that I'll discuss, but a lot of excitement and in the large academic centers, movement towards using the second generation FLT3 inhibitors like gilteritinib up front. I'll show some of that data to show why we're excited about this. So one of the key things now in acute myeloid leukemia is that we do require molecular mutation testing at baseline for all patients. This is both for prognostic value as well as for therapy selection. So as you see, the ELN 2017, which will likely be updated in the near future, already does incorporate different molecular mutations in addition to the traditional cytogenetics that we have been using for acute myeloid leukemia prognostication. And so you see here NPM1, FLT3 mutations, and others such as ASXL1, TP53, RUNX1 have now been identified as independent prognostic impact mutations that could put a patient in a higher or lower group. The other important thing is that individual mutations, while important, are not giving us the complete story. So as you can see, if somebody emails me, which we do get a lot of emails like this, saying, I have a 50-year-old with a FLT3 mutation, what do you suggest? I really cannot give any clear guidance, because if that patient has a low FLT3 allelic ratio with an NPM1, the patient potentially could be a more favorable. On the other hand, if that patient has a high FLT3 ITD burden with no NPM1, then that patient is adverse. So you can see, having a FLT3 mutation alone, you could still be in favorable, intermediate, adverse, and we really need to know the allelic burden or allelic ratio as well as the co-mutations. And this is just the beginning. We now know that other co-mutations, such as having DNMT3A along with NPM1 FLT3, could further have a prognostic impact, maybe TET2 and others. So I think this field will get more and more fine-tuned with time. So one of the first things that started occurring with the FLT3 mutations is when we identified that these were adverse prognostic factor, we started taking these people to transplant. This is one of the initial papers now 12 years ago that showed the impact of transplant in improving outcomes in patients who had FLT3 mutated AML. This benefit was specifically seen in FLT3 mutated. There was not as much as a benefit in people who had mutated NPM1 without FLT3. So transplant has been one of our go-to approaches for all FLT3 mutated patients in the frontline setting. The next thing that we have been looking at is incorporation of novel FLT3 inhibitors. So as you can see in this slide, there are many different FLT3 inhibitors that are now available, either approved or in clinical trials for treatment of FLT3 mutated AML. These include approved agents, midostaurin in combination induction chemotherapy, as well as in the relapse refractory setting, gilteritinib, which is approved in the United States, and quizartinib, which is not approved in the United States, but approved in Japan and is being evaluated in frontline phase 3 study. In addition to this, there are other FLT3 inhibitors, such as crenolinib, Hanmi drugs, Fujifilm, that are also in advanced clinical development at this time. I'll briefly go over the design of the RATIFY study. This was a very critical study. In fact, the first frontline study showing a targeted therapy added to backbone induction chemotherapy could improve outcome. Here we used a backbone of 3+7, and patients received either 3+7 with midostaurin or 3+7 placebo in the frontline setting. These were all FLT3 mutated patients, either ITD or TKD, and the primary outcome was survival. The midostaurin here was given on day 8 through 21, continued with the consolidation on day 8 through 21, and then patients could continue maintenance with midostaurin daily continuously for up to 1 year. Here are the results of the study. As you can see, the overall survival was significantly improved with a 4-year survival of 51% compared to 44% in patients who received midostaurin with 3+7 versus those who received placebo. Importantly, what was seen is that the benefit of midostaurin was noted across all ITD high, ITD low, and TKD mutations. Now, in the end of the day, although this is an improvement, it is not a game changer yet. We think this was the first important step in identifying FLT3 as a prognostic mutation, applying it in the real world setting, incorporating a multikinase inhibitor, and improving survival. However, if you do use midostaurin and take the patient's transplant, so not just doing one thing, but doing both approaches, then you may really get an improvement in outcome. So if you catch your patient like this patient with a FLT3 ITD mutation, you add midostaurin to your induction backbone, and you try to take that patient transplant quickly in the first remission, ideally after 1 or 2 cycles of treatment, then you can see those patients could have up to 60-70% 4-year survival, which is dramatic because historically, FLT3, when first identified, they had a 4 to 5 year survival of only 20-30%. So it's usually not just one intervention, but a combination of interventions that is going to give you a real benefit. The third step that emerged was the addition of a post-transplant maintenance. So you identified FLT3, you gave it a FLT3 inhibitor with induction, you took the patient to transplant, let's say after two or three cycles, everything has been done well. Now, can you further improve that? And the data now suggests, with two randomized phase two studies, one out of the German cooperative group, other out of China, showing that addition of a post-transplant maintenance with the FLT3 inhibitor, sorafenib was the one used in those two studies, significantly improved both event-free survival and overall survival. And in our centers, in many large academic centers, we are trying to put 100% of our patients post-transplant who have a FLT3 mutation on a FLT3 inhibitor. Now, we believe gilteritinib is a more effective and potent drug, and there is a large phase 3 post-transplant maintenance study of gilteritinib versus placebo that has completed enrollment through the bone marrow transplant network, and we hope to see that data. But at our center, we are frequently using gilteritinib post-transplant maintenance, but if one is not comfortable with that, I would definitely recommend using sorafenib, but some form of FLT3 inhibitor maintenance post-transplant. And now, after step 1, 2, 3, we said, well, we believe gilteritinib, maybe quizartinib, pirfenidone are highly effective drugs. They've shown single agent activity of 50% compared to 5 or 10% with sorafenib midostaurin. Can this be leveraged into combining them upfront and further improving this outcome with transplant and with post-transplant maintenance? And so this is some of the early data from the phase 1 studies that combined the second generation FLT3 inhibitors, as we call them, such as gilteritinib, crenolinib, quizartinib, with the backbone of 7+3. And again, these are different studies, so we're doing cross-study comparisons, phase 3 versus phase 1, a lot of caveats there. But again, we look at encouraging response rates, 90% and higher with the second generation FLT3 inhibitors. So this is what has got us excited, that if we use a second generation FLT3 inhibitor, take the patient transplant, do maintenance maybe with second generation drug like gilteritinib, then we could potentially get up to 80% or so remission and cure rates, which would be outstanding. Very similar to the paradigm that's emerging, for example, in Philadelphia positive ALL, with ponatinib being used upfront after transplant, and we're getting to 75-80% 5-year survival rates. So at this time, I'll turn it back to Dr. DiNardo. And, you know, we've used a lot of different FLT3 inhibitor combinations with gilteritinib, quizartinib, midostaurin. What are some of the side effects that you've seen, and how do you kind of use this regimen in practice?
I think the most important side effect to be aware of when we are using FLT3 inhibitors is GI toxicity and probably QTC prolongation, particularly with the second generation FLT3 inhibitors like gilteritinib and quizartinib. I think all of them are fairly straightforwardly managed in terms of nausea, vomiting, diarrhea. We have good anti-emetic and supportive care, but it's just something to be aware of. I think especially with midostaurin and sorafenib, the first generation, there is a lot of GI toxicity. And then in terms of the QTC monitoring, I think, you know, we need to pay attention to the many other QT prolonging medicines that are very standardly used in patients with AML. For instance, fluoroquinolones, azoles, the antiemetics themselves. You know, so monitoring QTC prolongation is important with the second generation FLT3 inhibitors, but oftentimes just modifying the supportive care agents that they're on can help to, you know, manage the QTC prolongation if it happens, and allow you to continue on at the appropriate dose.
Yeah, I think GI and E, you know, cardiac are probably the two. And then, of course, the third is, you know, myelosuppression, because we're adding a third drug. And so often we have to, as you know, we have to delay the cycle sometimes, and, you know, we cannot be rigid about the 28-day cycle that sometimes people get very rigid about in the community. So often we do see cycles go out to 35, 40 days. And as long as we're monitoring closely, confirming remission, I think this is okay. But both gilteritinib, midostaurin, as well as quizartinib, which we have used quite extensively, are quite well-tolerated and safe drugs in general. We do not see too many symptoms or issues with them. And in general, I think we have been able to administer these FLT3 inhibitors to almost close to 100% of our frontline patients who have a FLT3 mutation. I cannot think of a scenario where we would say, I absolutely would not use a FLT3 inhibitor. We may shorten the duration, adjust the doses in certain patients, but I think our goal at MD Anderson has been to give FLT3 inhibitor for all FLT3 mutated frontline patients. Okay, so here I will turn it to Dr. DiNardo to discuss our next case. Please, Dr. DiNardo.
Absolutely. So our second case is a 75-year-old gentleman who is presenting with pancytopenia in the setting of an upper respiratory tract infection. So his counts are on the low side, a white count of 1.5, hemoglobin 8.2, platelets of 94,000, neutrophil count is low. He has normal other organ function, renal function, liver function is okay. His LDH is mildly elevated. His performance status is 1. He has a past medical history significant of type 2 diabetes and coronary artery disease and atrial fibrillation. He is referred to a hematologist where a bone marrow evaluation is performed and does confirm a diagnosis of AML, 32% blasts with underlying MDS-related changes, trisomy 8 cytogenetics, and an NPM1 and an IDH2 mutation. And so, you know, the first question is, you know, is this scenario commonly seen, and why in particular is this a challenging case? And I'll pivot back to Dr. Javer to kind of give his thoughts on this, and then we can go into a little bit more detail.
Yeah, thank you very much. Absolutely, very common case. I would say the age range and presenting features are almost close to 30 to 40% of the AML patients we see above 70 years of age. Mutations are interesting. This patient does have slightly favorable mutations, NPM1 IDH, but does have background MDS. I think the major challenges are the age of this patient, 75, where, you know, intensive chemotherapy, in my opinion, I know many of us at MD Anderson will agree, is something we would not consider at this age for 99% of our patients. So I think we're looking at lower intensity, but now effective lower intensity combinations, which I'm sure you'll discuss.
That's exactly right. I think, you know, it's a particularly challenging case because we have so many different options available. So these are all options that are available, approved for a patient. So, you know, do we give an intensive chemotherapy-based regimen with 7 and 3 with gemtuzumab or CPX351 given the underlying MDS changes? Or do we prioritize a lower intensity combination, hypomethylating agent with venetoclax, low-dose ARC, venetoclax, classicib? Patient has an IDH2 mutation, so would we think about an asciminib-containing regimen, either alone or with azacitidine? And I think as Dr. Javer mentioned, that 75 does not preclude intensive chemotherapy, but given that our lower intensity therapies now are showing kind of equivalent responses with excellent durability, you know, the question is, you know, do we really want to prioritize intensive chemotherapy in someone who is on that older age range with underlying comorbidities, even though the performance status is 1? And so this just provides a little bit of data showing that, you know, 30-day mortality does increase with increasing age and increasing performance status, which really does, I think, have to factor into the decisions we make. And so in terms of optimal treatment choices, I would say in general, intensive chemotherapy for someone in their 70s who has underlying comorbidities, especially someone with, you know, NPM1 IDH mutations, that this patient is going to respond incredibly well to lower intensity combinations. And so we actually have different options available. I think the vast majority of providers throughout the United States are going to prioritize an azacitidine venetoclax regimen based on the VIALE-A data, which is very appropriate. We have a, you know, more than 70% composite remission rate. Median survival is about 2 years. And patients with that specific, you know, NPM1 IDH2 co-mutations are doing particularly well. But there is also data with AZA and asciminib with a composite remission rate above 60% and a similar median overall survival. So that wouldn't necessarily be an incorrect option either. And asciminib alone, I would really kind of restrict for a particularly frail patient that, you know, you really want to focus on just an oral outpatient regimen. In terms of toxicity management, I think, you know, we'll get into this probably a little bit more, but just to provide a little bit of guidance, I think when you're using azacitidine and venetoclax, the things you really want to be aware of are the risk of cytopenias and myelosuppression, because even though we call this a lower intensity regimen, we absolutely see cytopenias that oftentimes go beyond that 28 days. So again, that 28-day cycle is a bit of a misnomer. Oftentimes we're giving patients 5 or 6 week cycles now. The most important thing is to do a bone marrow around about the end of the first cycle, somewhere between day 21 and day 28, to see if your patient's already in a leukemia-free state. Because if you've cleared the leukemia and the counts are still low, And then the counts are still low because the patient hasn't had time to recover their bone marrow function yet. So you wait a week or two, you hold the venetoclax to start the second cycle. So that's just a really important point. And then also being aware of dose modifications with azoles. There are adjustments which are significant. So a 50% venetoclax reduction with moderate CYP3A inhibitors like fluconazole or isavuconazole, and at least a 75% reduction with the strong ones like voriconazole, posaconazole, with a package insert specifically recommending 70 milligrams of venetoclax when you're using posaconazole. So just important things to be aware of. So Dr. Dauber, any particular pearls of wisdom in terms of treating a patient if you've decided that you're going to do an HMA ven, and how you would kind of optimize their therapy?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is a regimen that I think we're using very extensively at MD Anderson. We've been using it for the last 5 years, treated hundreds of patients. And as you said, I think the key factor here is that we cannot really try to adhere, and we should not try to adhere to these 28-day cycles. I would say in our experience and published data, most of these cycles are running 35, 42 days, and that is okay because it is not impacting the remission rates or the MRD. The second factor is, as you said, we do a planned staged interruption of therapy, and many large academic centers across the US are doing this now, where we confirm a remission with the bone marrow around day 28. Once we show there's marrow remission, often we see that's with hypoplasia, aplasia, insufficiency, then we know that this is drug-related myelosuppression. We safely hold the venetoclax for 12 to 14 days, if needed, give growth factors, and then we're usually able to continue with cycle 2, where we usually shorten the venetoclax to 21 days, sometimes even down in subsequent cycles to 14 days. So I think, as we say, there's an art of venetoclax. It's a very effective drug. However, it's not like using AZA alone, which is, as you know, a lot of emails and questions we get from community. You cannot just give it and keep giving cycles 28 days. You need frequent labs, early marrow, confirmed remission, and hold therapy. So I think if you do all that, though, this is really a very, very effective and safe regimen.
Absolutely. We'll move on to the third case, which is one where I think it is a little bit challenging. I think the jury is still out in terms of what the best treatment strategy is. And so interested, Dr. Dauber, to hear your thoughts on this. So this is a 65-year-old female who's presenting with pancytopenia, again, in the setting of an upper respiratory tract infection. So that, you know, first sentence is very similar to our 75-year-old that we just talked about. Counts are low. Normal renal and liver function. LDH is mildly elevated. Again, very similar. Performance status is 1, but the difference here is the past medical history. So this patient has a history of breast cancer, has had chemotherapy and radiation, although it was many years ago. And this patient's bone marrow evaluation shows us, again, elevated blasts with underlying MDS-related changes, but the genomics are different. So this patient has complex cytogenetics, a deletion 5q, a monosomy 7, and on a NGS panel looking at common AML mutations, a P53 mutation is detected. So this patient started off very similar to our other patient, but again, the genomics are different. So this patient has complex cytogenetics and a P53 mutation. So treatment decisions, you know, while many of the same treatment options are available, the expectations are a little bit different. And Dr. Dauber, I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit about kind of this scenario. Is this something that we see often, and why is this particularly challenging?
Yeah, thanks, Dr. DiNardo. This is a very challenging case, you know, for us, as you know, kind of now probably one of the key spearheads for research in AML and MDS is how to address TP53 mutated AML and MDS. And that's one of the reasons, because azacitidine has been so effective and safe and improved outcomes in many, many subsets of AML. However, unfortunately, TP53 remains where over time, with more analyses, updated data from the phase 1b studies, the VLA studies that you conducted, as well as now our internal data set, seems to suggest that venetoclax has marginal and some would argue no improvement in the TP53 mutated AML. So this population remains one where we are still in a major unmet need. Now, there are new drugs that you will discuss that we're hopeful about. But today, if you look at a TP53 mutated AML, even if you look at azacitidine data, the response rates are about 50-55%, which is not bad, but the median survival is only 5 to 7 months, which is not better than we were getting with DAC or AZA alone. So this is, I think, the biggest challenge for this patient.
That's exactly right. So again, you can see there are many different treatment options. You know, this is a 60-some odd fit patient, PS of 1, no significant underlying comorbidities that would preclude intensive chemotherapy. So we could think about 7+3 or CPX-351, given this patient has an antecedent MDS and a therapy-related AML. We can think about hypomethylating therapy. There's been data on 10-day decitabine as being particularly effective at eradicating, at least for a short period of time, P53 clones. And then the venetoclax combinations, as well as clinical trials, which are showing what appears to be particular benefit in patients with P53 mutations. And that in particular is APR246, now aprenetapopt, and the CD47 antibodies, including magrolimab. So just to kind of remind the audience that we think this doesn't happen that often, but it really is almost 20% of our AML patients can be therapy related or in the setting of complex cytogenetics with a P53 mutation. So it absolutely is the minority, but it's a significant minority and one that we absolutely need to be kind of thinking about and trying to optimize their therapy. So we have many different treatment options. And so, you know, I think compared to a standard hypomethylating agent regimen alone, or a standard 7+3 based therapy, where we can expect a remission rate under 30% or so. You know, there are some hints that remissions are higher with some of our newer therapies. Hypomethylating agent with venetoclax, for instance, with the VIALE-A data, had a CR/CRI rate of 55%, which is certainly improved compared to azacitidine alone. But then when you look at the overall survival, we're really kind of yet to kind of really move the needle in the sense where kind of standard overall survival for a P53 mutated patient is only, you know, 6 months or less. And so with many of our new therapies, we're still kind of right at that level. And that's why I think the new trials involving APR246 or magrolimab are seen as so exciting in our field, and hopefully the ongoing data will kind of prove that this is indeed something that is improving the duration of remissions and overall survival in our patients. So just going through a couple of the trials in particular. So we know, of course, that CPX-351, based on a randomized phase 3 study, shows an improved overall survival in patients who were eligible, which this patient certainly would have been with the therapy-related AML, with a improved overall survival. When you look at subgroups, and P53 is the column on the right, there are, evidence that intensive chemotherapy is probably not the best option for patients with P53 mutations. And so in this P53 mutated group, CPX versus 7+3, you know, you look down and the composite remission rate is fairly similar, and the median overall survival, unfortunately, still under 6 months. We talk about 10 days of decitabine. This is a kind of an infamous clinical trial that was published in the New England, looking at the fact that we can clear P53 mutations incredibly well when you're giving 10 days of decitabine for the first few cycles. However, those remissions are unfortunately quite short-lived, with a survival that that is kind of not improved, unfortunately. And so now we think about venetoclax combinations, because venetoclax combinations, you know, I am definitely a believer, and they have definitely taken the world by storm in terms of the efficacy in many different subsets. But you look at P53 mutations, which again is the column on the right, and the composite rate is good, especially with azacitidine, 55% composite remission, as is shown here. But again, durability of these responses is unfortunately still not where we want it to be, right around 6 months or so. And so just a little bit of information about APR246, which is a first-in-class small molecule, which is inducing apoptosis through reactivating the wild-type P53 conformation, with data in a small number, just a handful of patients so far with AML, although there are many more with MDS and P53 mutations, which show, again, a composite remission rate, a CR rate of about 50%, but an overall response rate higher, and a duration of remission kind of extending beyond even the overall survival in many of our other studies. So the hope is Many of these patients are coming off for transplant. Many of these patients are doing well. The follow-up is really short, so time will tell. And there are ongoing clinical trials looking specifically at this in a randomized fashion. And then the CD47 antibody, which has been presented by both Dr. Shellman and Dr. Daver, so he can give us his expert opinion looking at patients with AML. And this was not selected for patients with P53 mutations, but in a sizable enriched population of 12 patients with P53 mutations, the response rate was, you know, 3/4 of patients are responding. And those patients who are responding, you know, that again, the follow-up is short, but the 6-month overall survival is 90%. So again, you know, far exceeding the median overall survival in historical expectations. And so, you know, I think that is a hopeful rose-colored twist to what is a incredibly challenging patient population to treat that is still kind of an area where improvements are needed. So Dr. Daver, what do you think?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think we're very excited. That's our nature, to be optimist in the field of acute myeloid leukemia. As you mentioned, we have been very involved with both magrolimab APR. We have seen some really outstanding responses in some patients who I think otherwise would not have responded. But I think we need more time. And at this year's ASH, there will be the abstracts are out, so we can actually share some data. There will be an update on at least the azamagrolimab. The AZA-APR is in a phase 3 locked study right now, so we won't know till early next year. But now with about 35, 40 TP53 mutated, the responses are holding at around 75%, and the median survival is emerging now above 12 months. So we're hopeful that this is something real. Still, you know, 12 months is good when we talk about 6 months, but, you know, we want more. So the question is, can we move it further with triplet and other combinations? And I think that's what we're looking at. The other issue, which we see a lot with TP53 mutated AML, as you know, is that they also tend to have much more myelosuppression with the therapy. So our early mortality rates are quite high. So I think these are patients that we would all strongly recommend go on trials. You know, these trials for APR and magrolimab are open now at least 25, 30 centers in the US. So if you see such a patient, my strong recommendation would be contact your academic expert in your community or contact us if you like. And really, these patients would be best served on getting on one of these doublet or triplet trials.
Yep, I completely agree. My bias is that I think it is a very unusual patient with a P53 mutation that's responding and doing well with standard intensive chemotherapy. So I prioritize lower intensity regimens because the outcomes are about the same, but without the toxicity. But absolutely agree that, you know, you know, that clinical trials and in particular the ones that we were just describing are hopefully going to be the way to go and what we should think about for patients that are presenting in this situation to our clinics. And so I'll move on. I think Dr. Daver, you have the fourth case.
Okay, thank you. So this is our fourth case. So 69-year-old coming with fever, cough, seen by PCP, initially given Z-Pak. This is something we see commonly, that, you know, a lot of these AML patients are initially treated with supportive care, antibiotics, and then takes a few weeks till they eventually are diagnosed. So comes back later, continues to have fatigue, weakness. This results in a workup with blood counts, shows a white count low, ANCs low, hemoglobin, platelets all are low, so consistent with pancytopenia. So this is usually when the primary care physicians will start getting stressed out and anxious and call their hematologist, and usually the hematologist will see that patient very quickly, same day or next day. Sometimes admission is what we do. If we cannot get the patient over the weekend, we'll bring them straight to our emergency room and admit them through there, because we're thinking about an acute leukemia. I don't know if it's AML, ALL, but I'm thinking this is an acute leukemia. So some additional history, good performance status, retired school teacher, very active, walking daily, has diabetes and coronary artery disease, but none of these are very active at this time, well controlled on medications, no recent major surgeries or medical events. So the patient, as discussed, is referred, seen by hematologist, quick bone marrow done, overall stable, so is being monitored closely in the outpatient setting with labs every 2 to 3 days. Bone marrow comes back 4 or 5 days later, 44% blast with significant background dysplasia, and has some adverse cytogenetics, including deletion 7q in the analyzed chromosomes. Molecular here shows ASXL SF3B1 mutations, and the other mutations that we always check for to put the patients into targeted therapies, which have the best outcome, are negative, which include FLT3, IDH1, IDH2, and as you heard from Dr. DiNardo, TP53, for which we are going for the magrolimab and APR. So you have this patient now without a clear targetable mutation, but with adverse cytogenetics. And the question is, what would you do and what are the challenges? And I'll turn this over to Dr. DiNardo for her thoughts.
So, you know, this is, again, a patient that is kind of right in that sweet spot where you're trying to decide intensive chemotherapy versus lower intensity combinations. You know, that age of 69 is someone who you really could be considering either option. And, you know, and these are not just made up cases, right? The median age of AML is 68. So we frequently have patients that are exactly this situation. And so, you know, when we think about, you know, genomics, of course, you know, that would have helped identify a targeted treatment strategy. And so, you know, and so now the question is, you know, do we prioritize a, you know, an intensive chemotherapy like a CPX351 or an HMA venetoclax regimen? And honestly, I think, you know, there's probably people on both sides of the fence. My bias is going to be a hypomethylating venetoclax regimen, especially with the high risk cytogenetics with that deletion 7. Because again, I know intensive chemotherapy has less effectiveness in that population. And so, you know, if I'm seeing equivalent outcomes with a lower intensity combination, I'm usually going to prioritize that. But, you know, but CPX is also an important consideration.
Yeah, thank you very much. I mean, I think these are the real world discussions we're having, and I don't think one is right or wrong. Both of those are FDA guidance. And in fact, I mean, technically, you have many treatment options if you're going just by the guidelines that could be used in this patient, because as Dr. DiNardo mentioned, he's relatively young. We could give intensive chemo for sure. If he had a core binding factor, for example, we would give him intensive chemo. So it's not a fitness issue, but the question really is will he benefit from intensive chemo? And I think that's becoming more of our key for making decisions, is not just whether one can get intensive chemo and tolerate it, but really, will one benefit from that, or could they benefit equally or maybe even more with some of the lower intensity? So for this patient, you know, I think HMA ven and CPX would be, in my mind, the top two choices, as Dr. DiNardo said, that we would have to discuss with the patient, you know, look at the donor status, what is our kind of eventual goal or even near-term goal. Of course, FLT3 inhibitors wouldn't be used here. 3+7 gemtuzumab, really gemtuzumab, as you know from published data, the maximum benefit is in core binding factor, as well as NPM1 mutated without FLT3. And that's really where we're using it. We're not using it in the adverse for sure, where it's shown no benefit on the large meta-analysis. And the intermediate one could consider it, but we prefer adding drugs like venetoclax, FLT3 inhibitors, IDH inhibitors, going for targeted therapies. And then decitabine 10 days alone, as Dr. DiNardo mentioned, there was excitement 4 or 5 years ago. We did a randomized study looking at 5 versus 10 days. We didn't see clear benefits. So we don't think that just decitabine 10 days on its own is a major breakthrough. Maybe if you added venetoclax to it, there is some improvement compared to AZA venetoclax. So I'll talk a little bit about this group, because this is a group that is growing, and I expect, and we expect in the next 10 years, will continue to grow. So this is a patient with AML MRC per the WHO classification. It really includes three groups of patients. So you have those who have a known history of MDS, MPN. This is easy because those patients were seen in the clinic, in the community, known MDS, getting growth factors, getting HMA, and one day, 1 or 2 or 3 years later, they progress to AML, come to you. So you know that history, that this is an MDS transformed to AML. The second group is the patients who have a prior chemotherapy or radiation therapy for another malignancy. So Hodgkin's lymphoma, breast cancer, colorectal, they've got some chemo radiation 2, 5, 7 years ago, and now they come with AML. You take a good history and you know this is a therapy-related AML. And then the third group is the one that is often missed, but is one that we are picking up more and more using FISH and cytogenetics. And this is patients who have MDS-related cytogenetic changes. And there's a whole list of the cytogenetics as one can look at. So if you see a patient, you do a bone marrow, you get cytogenetics, it's important to make sure you're not missing a MDS-defining cytogenetic change. And this includes deletion 5 and 7, 17. One doesn't have to remember the list, but the big ones are 5, 7, 17 in 3 and 1. So if you see these chromosome changes, think about something other than traditional 3+7 or flag IDA, maybe CPX, maybe HMA-VEN, or maybe clinical trials, again, with those newer drugs that we talked about, magrolimab, APR, or combinations of those with HMA-VEN. Now, the other interesting thing is that we are starting to find that there are particular mutational groups that are also associated with these MDS-related AML. And that's why specifically for this patient, who was a real-world patient, the mutations, if you notice, were ASXL1, SF3B1. So these mutations are common MDS or MDS-MPN mutations. And when we see these mutations in patients with AML, we start thinking about secondary or therapy-related acute myeloid leukemia, again, because we may consider other treatments such as CPX or HMA-VEN-based and not do traditional intensive chemotherapy. This was very nice work done by Coleman and Lindsley and group, where they found mutations that were more clearly associated with the secondary therapy-related AML. So briefly to go over the study, as was just mentioned, CPX351 and HMA-VEN are the two choices. I think one could argue strongly for either one. This is the data for the CPX351 versus 7+3. These were all patients who had either therapy-related AML, prior chemoradiation for another cancer, secondary AML, MDS or MDS-MPN transforming to AML, or AML with MDS-defining cytogenetic changes. Note there were no MPN transformed to AML here. So this is a second group like TP53, which is a major unmet need. Patients with myelofibrosis, ET, who transformed to AML, both the CPX351 as well as HMA-VEN, and almost all of our trials actually exclude those. So we're still trying to find new treatments for those. But for MDS transformed as well as therapy-related and secondary AML, this is a study that included all of those. And this is the high-level results. You already heard them from Dr. DiNardo. Median overall survival was improved. But again, at the end of the day, we're talking about 10 months versus 6 months. So it is a benefit. And in this very high-risk patient population, any benefit is a good benefit. So we do think this is a positive study. And especially, again, similar to FLT3, if you give CPX to that patient with secondary therapy-related AML and take him to transplant, you may then have a realistic chance of two-year-plus survival that could go out to 40-50%, which historically is not something we have been able to achieve in this high-risk population. This, to me, was actually very interesting and encouraging data, because there has been a lot of debate, even in our group, about is CPX351 really a clear benefit? You know, there is some improvement in response survival. How does that play out? And I thought that this abstract that looked at five-year follow-up really does show a clean benefit. So when you look at the curve on the survival landmark from the time of transplant, so these are people who got CPX versus 3+7, went to transplant. What happened to those patients? And you can now see at 5 years, 50% of those patients versus 25% were alive. I mean, to have 50% therapy-related secondary AML patients, whatever you do to get them to that is outstanding. So I think there are patients maybe where you are trying to take them to transplant, you could give them CPX, take them to transplant, maybe some time form of post-transplant maintenance could be considered, and you could have a realistic chance of getting up to half of these people to long-term survival. So very nice, encouraging data published recently. Now, from side effect profile, it's important to note, and this is a common misconception, CPX351 is not low intensity. This was not developed to compete with or replace HMA-VEN or HMA-CD47 or other drugs. This is actually a intensive chemo formulation, but a better tolerated, more effective, and improving outcome intensive chemotherapy. The drugs are actually the same drugs, anthracycline, cytarabine. And so that's why I show this slide, because the median time to recovery with CPX is about 35 days. In fact, it's, if anything, a little bit longer than 7+3. But the good thing is we see that the GI toxicity and the early mortality is lower. So I think because of the liposomal formulation, the toxicity on the GI tract with anthracycline is mitigated, but one does have to know counter recovery is slow. And in our experience at MD Anderson, we admit all of these patients. We treat these patients like we would somebody on FLAG-IDA or other inductions, and we take all the precautions. And with that, we have been able to get them safely through inductions. Here we show the early mortality, and I think one of the main reasons for the improved survival has come from the reduced early mortality. As you can see, the 60-day mortality is 13% versus 21%, quite significantly reduced. But also, as you can see here, a lot of people debate and argue that, you know, in their experience, in the 60-plus patients, they don't have high early mortality. Well, this was a study done in 2015, academic centers, phase 3 randomized study. You can see in 60-plus patients, even with all of those controls, the early mortality, 60-day mortality, was 21-22%. So I think one has to be very careful when they evaluate their patients and think about the early mortality, because most of the randomized data is still showing between 20-25% induction mortality, suggesting maybe these people were not great candidates for induction chemotherapy. And with HMA-VEN and other HMA combos, that is an area that I think will be used more and more. In our experience, as I mentioned, MD Anderson, we admit these patients, we treat them like any cytotoxic RSC anthracycline induction. We do closed blood work daily. Once they're stable around day 28, we let them outpatient and do monitoring. With that approach, we have found CPX and CPX combinations that we use as a good approach. So here I'll turn it back to Dr. DiNardo. So with your experience, how has CPX been tolerated, and what is the kind of patient you would think about using CPX?
I think CPX-351 really has been a nice addition to our treatment armamentarium, if you will. I think patients really like getting intensive chemotherapy that doesn't have them lose their hair. It seems silly, but it is, you know, that's a nice thing. I think the cytopenias, as you mentioned, are really important. So you cannot assume this is a lower intensity therapy. People have cytopenias that are significant and that are prolonged. And so that's exactly why we keep people in the hospital, because, you know, neutropenic fevers and issues happen at the nadirs of these cycles. And so that is in my opinion, the best kind of optimal therapy management piece of advice. In terms of who would not be a great candidate for CPX-351, well, again, as you said, this is, you know, anthracycline-based, cytarabine-based chemotherapy. And so if you have a patient, for instance, that has breast cancer and has had a lot of anthracyclines in the past, or someone with underlying cardiomyopathy with a low EF, that is someone who should not be getting this type of therapy. But in general, I think I think patients have tolerated this, you know, well. The cytopenias are prolonged and are important to be aware of. But in general, I've found that this to be kind of a intensive chemotherapy regimen that can be well tolerated in those older therapy related AML patients.
Yeah, and that's kind of been our experience, you know, in MD Anderson, is with the correct checks and monitoring and, again, inpatient use of this, we have been able to, deliver this regimen. I think one of the key issues, though, is with Aza-Ven, we are able to add other drugs to it, and that's not something we discussed, but at this year's ASH, it will be discussed quite a bit. So adding FLT3 inhibitors like gilteritinib, quizartinib, IDH inhibitors to Aza-Ven, or new drugs like magrolimab or cusatuzumab or APR to backbone of Aza-Ven, we hope will further push that response and duration and survival up. And I think that is a challenge for drugs like CPX and maybe even standard intensive chemo, where you are already kind of at the threshold, you know, of toxicity in a 68-year-old. And I think that may become a key deciding factor in the next 5 years if some of these triplets really show dramatic activity, whether they will eventually actually turn out to be superior to standard induction or CPX, not even just for older patients, but potentially in the future for younger patients. So from here, we'll kind of discuss some of the, I think one area we didn't touch on, we didn't have in our cases, but is important is maintenance therapy. So there is a drug, CC486, oral HMA therapy that has been approved in the maintenance setting. This was based on a study done in patients 50 to 70 years of age who had completed their planned induction consolidation, and importantly, were not going to transplant. So either they were not candidates for transplant because of fitness comorbidities, organ dysfunction, or they did not have a donor, or the patient decided for some reason they didn't want transplant. So it's important that this is not a replacement for transplant, but this study allowed people who completed induction consolidation, were above 50, and could not go to transplant. And it showed that the addition of the CC486 in this setting improved survival as well as event-free survival quite significantly compared to just observation. So Dr. DiNardo, what's your take on the CC486 data? Where do you see this being used?
I think kind of two important points about CC486. One is that it is so exciting to have a maintenance therapy option, right? This has been something that in other hematologic malignancies like ALL, we've been able to use for years and improve upon our patients' duration of remission and overall survival as a result. And it's been something that, you know, has made sense for AML for a long time, but we have yet, you know, with the FLT3 inhibitors and maintenance, and now with CC486, it's clear that maintenance is part of the paradigm of treating an AML patient. So I think that's really important. And then the other thing that I think is really kind of an important advance about CC486 is the fact that it is an oral formulation of a hypomethylating agent. It is not bioequivalent IV azacitidine, but it has you know, lower PK properties in general. But I think this opens up the door for future clinical trials and maybe future combinations of CC486 with other things, in particular venetoclax, one of my key interests. Because I think our you know, older AML patients that are spending so much time going back and forth to the hospital for, you know, blood checks and transfusions and IV or subcutaneous injections, I think having oral formulations of things is going to be a really nice addition to our AML therapy.
Yeah, I agree. And I think what you mentioned is very important, though, that there are two oral hypomethylating agents, which is also going to create more confusion. It's a great thing to have, but it has to be used separately. So you have the CC486, the oral azacitidine formulation that was only tested in maintenance and is actually significantly lower PK values than the IV aza, which may have been to its benefit, which is why it could be taken for 2 years, whereas it may have been hard to give standard IV aza. And then you have the oral ASTX, which is the oral decitabine formulation, which was actually developed to be very equivalent PK equivalence approval for decitabine. And so with both of these, I think we have to be careful in what setting they're used. But again, to us, I think these are good additions, major improvement in quality of life with oral agents, but only a starting point, and then we can combine these with the venetoclax, FLT3, TP53, other drugs that are emerging. So then ASH is coming up quite soon. We're recording this in November 22nd, so 2 weeks away. So Dr. DiNardo, what are some of the interesting things you're looking forward to seeing or presenting at ASH?
I think one of the things I am interested in seeing presented at ASH is the use of venetoclax with intensive chemotherapy. We talk a lot about how venetoclax is now kind of changing the standard of care in our older patients with poor performance status receiving lower intensity therapy. And you know, venetoclax synergizes well with many different things. Is there a role for it with intensive chemotherapy? And that data will be shown. We have several different MD Anderson-led studies looking at FLAG-IDA with venetoclax, CLIA with venetoclax that will be shown. I think everyone's really excited about seeing some of the updated data on magrolimab that you mentioned, on some of the other kind of monoclonals and immunotherapy type agents. I think, you know, the field would really love to be able to kind of incorporate some of those as novel therapies as well. And as you mentioned, the triplet data, right? So there's a lot of people now using azacitidine and venetoclax as a backbone. And then you identify your patient has a targetable mutation. Can you add a IDH inhibitor, a FLT3 inhibitor, a P53 modulating agent for patients with those mutations?
Yeah, same. You know, things that I'm quite excited to see or have presented. And I think venetoclax, we have just touched on the surface with the HMA Lotus RC combos, which is great, and it's got them approved. But I think there's much more that will come out of these. As you said, the FLAG-IDA and the CLIA combinations are exciting, and then there will be data combining with FLT3 inhibitors, with gilteritinib, with quizartinib, and both doublets and triplets, quite striking response rates as well as durations of response survival. So I think this is a drug that we will find a way to use in many different combinations going forward. Also, there's a lot of nice subset analyses that are coming both from our group as well as from others, looking at different molecular impact with HMA-VEN outcome in TP53 and IDH that you are doing, and then others with FLT3 looking across trials. So I think this data will help us understand much better in each molecular group whether HMA-VEN is the optimal, are there other approaches, are there triplets that could be used. So I think it's going to be very exciting. And then CC486, again, there will be updated data looking at MRD conversion, right, rates. So that'll be nice to see. And in fact, there is a good MRD negative conversion rate, which shows that this is not just kind of a soft effect, but a real effect in converting people from positive to negative, which is something in AML that we have not seen. So hopefully we can build on that.
Agree.
I think with that, let me turn over to our closing slide. I think we've had a lot of good discussions. Any closing remarks from your side, Dr. DiNardo?
No, I just want to thank you for inviting me to be part of this activity. I think it's a very challenging thing for the kind of average oncologist to be able to stay on top of all of the new approvals in AML, not only which is the optimal treatment, but also how to best manage your patient going through it. You know, everything has side effects and tricks of the trade. And so being part of activities like this to try to make sure you are on top of kind of the best way to manage your patient, I think is a fantastic thing. So thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, thank you very much for giving us time and all of the very useful information. I think this is critical, right? I mean, we, both Dr. Donato, myself, and others, we are very aggressive in developing trials, pushing them, and of course, getting drug approvals is our first goal in life, basically, right now. And it's been great in AML to see that this is happening and continues to happen. But, you know, what we're starting to see is getting drug approved is half the battle. And then, you know, getting them used optimally is as much or maybe even more important. You know, we see data with AzaVen that others say, you know, I don't find this benefit, or I see early mortality, or I see, you know, high toxicity. And I think a lot of it has to do with how that is being done. You know, there are tricks. We've used AzaVen, for example, over 5 years to come to the point where we are, over 250 frontline patients. Absolutely, what we did in the beginning in 2015 was completely different from what we're doing today. And so there's a learning curve. The good news is I think there's a lot of expert hematologist oncologists, including ourselves, who are very happy to discuss at any time. You can email us. You can find our email on the internet, or just go to MD Anderson. Our phone numbers are there. And we get every day 5 or 6 emails or calls, and we're happy to provide input. And more importantly, we're happy to bring patients for trials. So if you see a frontline patient, TP53, you see a relapse patient, you don't have options, be happy to reach out to us or other academic centers in your location, Moffitt, Stanford, Dana-Farber, whatever it may be. You know, a lot of times I hear people saying, well, we're doing so well with AzaVen, so are we done? Absolutely not. I mean, you go from 15% 5-year survival to 35%, 40%, this is good, but we don't want to be 20 years from now at 35, 40%, 4 or 5 year survival. We want to be at 80, 90%. And I think we can get there like multiple myeloma did. 2000, 3-year median survival, 2019, 15-year median survival, and that is without using cytotoxic therapy. So this has been done by other heme malignancies. We think we can do the same. And so feel free to reach out to us. And again, thank you very much for viewing this activity, and we hope to talk to you all again in the near future. Bye.